God, I ask you, please help me welcome Paul W. from LA as our speaker tonight.
We get one of these. I have some fantastic fudge stuffing just kind of glued to the right side of my mouth. So. And I don't want to talk out of the wrong side of my mouth. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Paul. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm actually, my home group is Lucky 13 in Sunset Beach. I don't live in L.A. I live in Huntington Beach, but... And I'm addicted to this. God, I'll get everybody else here. But my home group, Lucky 13, is in it's on the sand in Sunset Beach, right behind Third Beach, which is the clubhouse. And we sit out on the sand in a little circle and quietly take each other's inventory. Last few years, we've been meeting online, and thank God for Zoom. I mean, I love to be in a room full of alcoholics, but when we are told that we have to stay home, I mean, my work, I'm 81, but I still work for a living, and I work at home, you know, and I miss being around real breathing, confused alcoholics. You know, it's like they're walking in a room with, and I show up. I got to tell you, I show up sometimes just, you know, like I have a guinea pig, and the guinea pig's name is Buddy Holly. I have a cat named Stormy Daniels. I try to put, you know, and Buddy Holly has, Buddy Holly's entire expression is this. And every now and then I show up in an A meeting just exactly like that. Just, you know, I'm looking up for the big amigo because that's where the answers come from. You know, but I just get, you know, I get confused. And I need desperately to be in an A meeting. And not once in a while. Often. The tea is silent, but I'm not. I just... You know, I'm an expert on it. It's exhausting explaining things you know nothing about. And when I got sober, I was 49 years old, and that was me. I was, you know, I was better at showing off than showing up. These days, I show up. And I will go anywhere in the world to speak at an AA meeting. I like the attention, frankly. You know, I do, you know. And I think that's one of the secrets of Alcoholics Anonymous is that if you're here a couple days, and reach after 7. You know, you've heard people say, you know, like, I mean, one of the first meetings I went to, I stood up and wanted to thank everybody for all of us who are here from rehab. And somebody in the room, you know, sit down and shut up, you know, which was probably appropriate to the times, but it's not in the big book. In the big book, it says that, you know, if somebody walks in you and you can... You know, our primary purpose is to stay sober and to carry the message. And if somebody walks in and you've got 2 days and somebody walks in and they are brand new, you know, and it's, you know, it's like you're getting hugged by Willie Nelson. Willie Nelson hugs you hard enough and long enough, you have to change your date. So some of these guys, you know, guys will come in and you look at them and you go, you know, and if you've got a couple days, if you've been here and they haven't, you can go over to that person and say, you got a big book. You got a big book. You want a cup of coffee, you know. What's your middle name? Never mind. Just kidding. Give yourself a little charge here, but that'll come back. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 49 when I got sober. I didn't have the best childhood, but I had the longest. I mean, it just, you know, it was... I was a construction brat. My dad was in construction, and we moved. I went to 9 schools by the time I was in the 9th grade. So I was always the littlest kid in school, and incidentally, don't worry about this, the height of this. I have spoken at meetings where all they saw was the hair, you know, and, you know, but, you know, if you tell the truth, and if I have to, I will stand on my big book. I've been standing on it for 31 years, and it's done right by me at every turn. My 32nd birthday is Tuesday, if I make it, and, You know, and it's just, it's a spectacular program with this thing that is as much to me is as much a living document as the Bible. I can open it up anywhere and find something that will just, you know, like, you know, I found everything I had ever looked for in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, that's what I just opened up to. And Boo, thank you for listening. I've been listening and looking for you. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I think the most important sentence in the big book is the spiritual life is not a theory, which translates to me as kindness. And what I found here was safety, and I found the elegance of kindness. I found people that, you know, and it's really, really interesting to be at a place in your life when, you know, I'm the perfect age to sit in a rocker on my porch and yell, get off my lawn, to people, you know, that's what, and I'm 81 years old, you know, and I ran this morning, you know, I run every morning, nobody was chasing me, I run faster up and down than I do forward, but bike out, and I get out and I do almost 3 miles every morning. I work out 3 times a week. I feel like a tired 34, and this is all Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I got here, I weighed 187. And I looked like one of those big blow-up dolls you push over and they come back up. And I came back up really slowly, you know, and they pushed me over. Well, a blow-up doll with bad breath, you know. I spent my whole life in the entertainment business. Pat McCormick is one of my best friends. He's 6'4", and I was like 5'2" in training. Pat McCormick played my daddy in the Smokey and the Bandit movies, and he used to look at me and go, little guy, you look like an aerial photograph, a human being. He said, I knew you were there because when we've been up a couple of days and nights like we have, your breath would spin the windmills in an old Dutch painting, I'm telling you right now. I had a lot of fun drinking. And outside issues. I snorted a lot of outside issues. If I'm taking the reins back from the big amigo these days, if I'm having one of those days when I'm getting all I am, I start to get a sore right hand. And that may not be important to you, but it is to me because I used to sleep holding onto a 2-gram bottle. And that's how bad the sleep, that's how bad the drugs I bought were. I would sleep with, you know, after doing cocaine. And I know it's an outside issue, but I gotta tell you, the reason I did it and the reason I couldn't quit and the terror that I managed to bring into my life, it doesn't matter what the substance is. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous is the most important, absolutely the most important piece of my life, because it is my life. I was talking about being little and two brothers that are both 6-footers. The reason I was so much shorter, well, I don't know at the beginning why, but when I was like 7 or 8, it was like, my dad was like, should he be at this age running under coffee tables? I mean, I was really little. And they said, you know, there's something wrong. Let's go see what's wrong with this kid. Because, you know, and we were living in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Con mi vatos, you know, así que quisiera hablar en español, así que tipo, no problema para mí. Bienvenido a Cristo Nueve. Esto es, this is heaven on earth. This is heaven on earth. But there was a doctor in Albuquerque, New Mexico, who said, I can make this little guy grow. We give him some male hormone, you know. So they gave me male hormone, and it didn't make me grow, but it kicked me into an early stage of puberty at about 8. And my family noticed, you know, because I lost interest in my toy chest, but my Aunt Edna's chest, all of a sudden I could, you know, And my dad noticed, and he said, William, what did you keep doing in the closet? I'd ask little girls, I'd say, let's go in the closet and kiss like they do in the movies. And that's me. I mean, I am like, let's kiss like they do in the movies. That's like the headwaters of who I am. And they noticed it, and they said, okay, off with it. No more hormones. None of that. That's not good. I mean, it's good, but it's not, I'm a songwriter. I spent my whole life writing basically what I call codependent anthems. I mean, they're just ouch mommy songs, pick me up and love me, and I think that's where it began. But the downside of it was that when they did that, it threw my body clock off. So I didn't get puberty until I was out of high school. Almost every alcoholic that I had at some point in a conversation will talk about the fact that we felt different. We just felt different. I just felt different. And it had nothing to do with my body. I felt that kind of different that is just, you walk into a room and you're just uncomfortable. So I would get louder. And I found that with a drink I could, that all of a sudden, I got calm, and with the right combination of dancing chemicals in my system, I could probably help you with anything, except I didn't know what I was talking about, but I was comfortable. And the relationship with alcohol began very early. I mean, when I was like a little guy, probably 5 or 6, my dad would give me a little glass of beer at the family Sunday picnics, I mean, that's 5 or 6, I held up my first liquor store when I was 7. No, that's not true. I'm sorry, my story is really very, very white bread. I mean, I'm a white bread alcoholic. I never came out of a blackout with a Russian arms dealer or a couple of hookers and Norman Mailer in Paris, I come out of a blackout in the boys' department of Sears, trying on sweaters, trapped in a distorted reindeer. So anyway, my dad was a sweet drunk. My dad was a sentimental man who he had a best friend named Ike McShane, and Ike McShane was drank with my dad almost every night, and we would live whatever we could find. Sometimes we'd have a nice little house. When the job was over, we'd go on to the next thing. And my dad did big projects, hospitals and hangars at airports and stuff like that. So it'd be like a year at one place, another year and all. And we were in Oklahoma. We were in Portsmouth, Ohio. Actually, Lucasville, Ohio. The only thing that's there and is still there is the prison. And my dad was, the only we could find a living was a 24-foot trailer. So it was me and one of my brothers, the other one was already off in the Navy, and my mom and dad living in a 24-foot trailer, and that's really, really small. But there was room for Dad and his Seagram 7 and his buddy Ike to drink with. And my dad would, it was a very quick little trip to the bed, which he could, I could hear them and they could hear me. My dad would get me up in the middle of the night to sing for Ike McShane. He would say, and he would cry. God, he would have loved AA if he'd found it. He would have loved AA. But he'd get me up and he'd go sing Danny Boy for Ike. And I would go, Dad, he goes, come on, sing Danny Boy for Ike. And Ike McShane hated me. The last thing Ike McShane wanted was to hear some gnome sing Danny Boy in the middle of the night. He was getting quietly fried, and then Paul would get to Paul Sr. My dad's name was Paul too. Paul Sr. would decide that he had to hear me sing it, and the look on Ike's face was just like he was just told him he was going to have a little dental work tonight, just get that look. And it amazed me that I could see it when I was like 6 or 7 or 8, and my dad never saw it. And the reason I bring that up is that I had the same blinders on while I was drinking. And it's kind of a way for me to make amends, to at least acknowledge all the Al-Anons in the room. And trust me, there are Al-Anons in the room. They're just scared. You know, come on, Al-Anons, you know, put your hands up because I want to know if you're here, and I want you to know how I recognize how damaging and dangerous and thoughtless an alcoholic can be. Me, not anybody else in the room, but for me, it's important when I pitch to bring that up, that you know what, we can be really, really, really scary. My dad, one night, I always tell this story when I speak. My dad got me up in the middle of the night one time, and he said, yeah, and he was fried. He was totally fried. And he said, get up, my son. I'm going to take you to the Cleveland Indians to play baseball. I'm going to go to see a Cleveland professional baseball game. And he was just, you know, so excited. It was raining sideways outside. It was so, he had a 50 Merc, like, you know, like James Dean had in Robo Dot a Cause. And I was tiny. I was in the back seat, and my dad and Ike McShane are in the front seat, passing a bottle back and forth, and he's going, you know where we're going? I'm going, don't watch me, Dad, watch the road. And I mean, I'm 81, and I can close my eyes, and I can see the car. Just, you know, the headlights are going off the road a little, off the road, wrong side of the road, back and forth. I mean, and it's just, I felt like if I concentrated on it enough, I could keep the car on the road. And that has to be just the headwaters of my own grandiosity. Because when you're a kid, and you're in that kind of danger, and the guy that's supposed to be taking care of you is so drunk that he can't keep the car on the road, rather than feel all that terror, what you do is you start giving yourself power. I can do this. I can keep it on. I can. There it is, and it's back. There it is, and it's back. My dad drove through this horrible rainstorm and to see the Cleveland Indians play baseball, and he drove to Cincinnati. Thank you. He drove to the wrong city. It was a perfect alcoholic moment. You know, he drove to, because the Cincinnati team doesn't play in anyway, the Cleveland Indians don't play in Cincinnati. So, anyway, we get to the ballpark and it's empty. So, well, let's be early. We're going to get great seats. You know? And he and Ike are looking at each other like, whoa. And so he walks over to the tickets, you know, the booths, and he looks at the schedule and he realizes what he's done. And I saw a move that I would probably recreate thousands of times, and it's this. It's just this. And it's like, it's just that alcoholic slump. You know what? You try to do something nice and they screw with you, you know. It's like, and he was wearing a white, what we call a wife beater these days, t-shirt, suit pants, and slippers. So he forgot to put shoes on to go to the ball game. And he came back to the car and he said, I'm sorry, my son, there's not going to be a ball game. And then he said something that I lived by for 49 years, but it's the thought that counts. And for 49 years, I was the thoughtiest little bastard you ever met. Until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had a sponsor. My first sponsor was a guy named Jerry Hunter. He passed away a few years ago. Jerry Hunter was about my size. He wrote a Full Dress Harley, and he said, you know, you walk into a church to speak, you honor what they ask you. You put a tie on. Jerry drove this big old bike, and he'd go back and forth on his toes, because he wasn't big enough for both feet to touch at the same time. You know. I had my last drink, I drank in high school I got out of high school. I went to a place where they were building a Six Flags, Texas, outside of Denver, and I'd gone to high school in Long Beach. flew home to help my mom raise my little brother. Went to apply for a job at this six. I went up there and with brand new boots on and my little lunchbox and everything, because they were hiring everybody in the world. And I walked up and the guy looked at me, and he said, "You know what?" And they were hiring guys to dig ditches. And he said, "You're too. I'm sorry, buddy, but you're too little to dig ditches." And I went, "Thank you. Oh God, thank you. I don't want to dig ditches. I want to do something else with my life." And I wanted to be an actor, so I went back to Hollywood, and I couldn't get arrested. I did a couple movies. I played kids. I was 22, and I was playing like 13-year-olds. You know, I looked like a kid till you put me next to a real kid, then I looked like a kid with a hangover. It was just mommy, that boy looks weird. That boy is weird. So I was working on a movie called The Chase, and there was a guy that had a guitar, and I picked it up, a guy that I was sharing a dressing room with, and I picked up his guitar because we were shooting at night, and there were some big stars in the movie, and I had a bit part that ran through almost the whole thing. Marlon Brando, Robert Redford, huge, huge stars and everything. But anyway, I picked up this guy's guitar and he said, "Josh, I'm Martin, leave it alone." I didn't know they had names, and I said, "Okay." And I bought a cheap one and I started doodling, and I found a place where I could put what I was feeling, and it was like therapy. It was just like, you know, I wrote 19 chorus social protest songs that nobody ever heard, and hopefully they never shall, because they were just horrific, you know. But I have had some wonderful breaks and some great people that I wrote with, and things went really well. And I drank to celebrate. And then I took all the other drugs. You know, I never did heroin. I knew I should have. The story would have been so much better. But I had some success, and alcohol made me feel like, you know, alcohol made me feel like I was right-sized in the world, you know. Cocaine made me feel like I could shoot basketball for money. It was just, all of a sudden I was like nothing but enthusiasm, and I was writing and talking, and I didn't want to leave the room. I was afraid I'd miss what I was saying. It's a wonderful question. And I had a wife and two beautiful children, and I had amazing success as a songwriter, and started acting, and it was like living dreams come true. Only thing missing in my life is what consumes me at this point, and that's gratitude. That's gratitude. I drive to Santa Maria, I walk into a room, and I feel more comfortable and safer than I do at the family Thanksgiving dinner. I just found my home. I found my tribe. You know, at the center of the herd, I can breathe. I can breathe. You're new. I can't wait for you to start feeling that. Because it's just an amazing gift, you know. I loved it. I have to tell you that I left my wife and my children for a 22-year-old psych major, and she said, I love you too much to watch you die. You're an addict, you're an alcoholic, I'm afraid you're going to die. And I went, that's amazing. I was just thinking of going to rehab. You know, it's like, no, I wasn't. I wasn't sick. I just didn't want to lose her, but I went to rehab for her. Didn't work. I went to a place called Shikshela where they do aversion therapy. It's awful. But I went about after, and I really was in love with this woman. At least I thought I was. The fact is, she was a young girl. She was 22 years younger than me, and I had no business being with her. But she did an amazing gift when she turned to me and said, "You know, you got to do something because I'm out of here." Because I did try to do something, but I went to a place that I didn't hear anything about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't get a sponsor. I had no design for living. But I had sobriety. There's a guy sponsor in Denver named Wes who coined that word, sobriety. It's absolutely I just wasn't drinking, and I had 7 months of sobriety, and I was fine. There's nothing wrong with, you know, I don't need a booze, I don't need no drink, I don't need nothing. Wow! You know, it's just awful. I went to Jamaica to work on a project, and I was there writing the songs I was supposed to be writing for the musical I was working on. I was trying to have a hit, and I got an idea for a song, and it was like the middle of the night, and I'm out there sitting by a pool at a beautiful home in Ocho Rios. And I write this song, and I go, damn, this is old. This is going to get it back, because getting it back was, you know, the career I thought I had been gone for 10 years when I got sober. 10 years. Still in my head, thinking it was, yeah, aren't you the hottest thing in town, and the phone was not ringing, you know. But the fact is that I, you know, 10 years. You know you're an alcoholic when you misplace a decade. I mean, that could be my, right there is my pitch for what it was like, you know. I misplaced a decade. I didn't, you know, Reagan was president? Jesus, nobody tells me anything, you know. But anyway, I'm writing this song that I know is going to get it back, and I get a little bit of sleep, and I get up, and it's like 2 in the afternoon. And I go and I sit down out by the pool, and I've got a little recorder that I've recorded this. Listen to what I recorded. I took my place beside you, girl. I don't remember the words, but I remember the melody. And I was feeling so just, oh my God, this is going to be great. And I listened to it. I took my place beside you, girl. And I went, oh Jesus. I mean, oh Jesus. I realized I had rewritten O Little Town of Bethlehem. I took my place beside you, girl. I don't know why, but I know. O Little Town of Bethlehem, I'm still waiting. Exactly, you know. And I was like, and at that exact moment, a guy with a white jacket and a tray and some ice and little bottles and all walked up, and he said, Mr. Williams, would you like perhaps a rum and coke? I said, yes. He didn't even hit the C on the coke. I was like, yes, I want one. You know what? I'm going to have one rum and coke because I'm the Paul Williams. And I have amazing, I have tenacity, I have discipline, you know, I'll have one rum and coke. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon in Ocho Rios, Jamaica, I had one rum and coke. At 2 o'clock in the morning, I was at Bob Marley's grave, explaining reggae to a lot of black people I didn't know. Just, right, you know, it's all about the back, you know. I know nothing about reggae. I know nothing about reggae. At my most sober, dedicated, honest moment, I know nothing about reggae. You know. I could study it for years and would still not know anything about reggae. Except it's beautiful. Except it's real. So I was off and running, and I was that. I mean, that was just me. You know, once you put alcohol in my system, there is a phenomenon that occurs. And how do we get out of that? Well, we get out of it, you know, by having that spiritual awakening, that moment of truth when we say something. Let me tell you about my moment of truth. I cannot even claim my moment of truth, because in a blackout I called a doctor and said I wanted to go to treatment. There's a story about how it happened, and guess what? I'm going to tell it. I went to Oklahoma City to do a concert with my band at the time. A rare booking, because I wasn't hardly working at all. And I'd been up about 3 days and nights with, you know, maybe an hour of sleep once in a while, but I was doing a lot of cocaine and drinking around the clock. And I was in my hotel room, and it was an afternoon gig, and what happened basically is the promoter came over and knocked on my door, and I walked out into the hallway of the hotel. And the way he describes it is, as we were walking along, he says it was as if, because I talked to him later, he said it was as if somebody picked you up and threw you against a wall, almost as high as your head. I was being bitten and tortured by this little version of my, in his car, And looking at the rearview mirror, I could see what looked like a miniature version of myself with big teeth and a horrible face. Like, it just awful. At that hotel, I was thrown down escalator stairs by that little guy. And there is no escalator in that building. But I saw it in the special movie. He took me over, and my band said, you know what, he said, I don't know what to do. And they said, don't what? We don't either. But he does get like this once in a while. Never that bad. I had a full-tilt psychotic episode. Canceled the gig, and the next day I did it, and I told the audience that I'd had a reaction to my meds. And I told them the truth. Because alcohol and the drugs, it kept the real world back here. Is how I kept stayed alive. I did the gig. I went back to L.A. and drank on the plane. Drank when I got back, because that's what I did. And it was like, I mean, I drank like I was Robert Mitchum, but I was in fact closer to Haley Mills. I mean, I just, a week after I got back to L.A., or may could have been as much as 8 or 9, 10 days, whatever, but in a blackout, I called a doctor and said I wanted to go to treatment. In a blackout, he called the next day. I said, somebody's using my body again. What are you talking about? He said, you said you wanted to go to treatment, and something happened. Poof. I don't know. I don't know why, but it was just, yeah, I've got to stop. I mean, it's just... It's, oh my God, it's 7:45. I'm going to get to sobriety. You're welcome. You're welcome. I loved it. I went to treatment. All I wanted to do was be around other alcoholics. I did something no other alcoholic had ever done. That was, I went to UCLA and got my certification as a drug and alcohol counselor. It was... Nobody ever done it before. It was the beginning of my Pauly Lama period. That's my nickname for my home group. It's the Pauly Lama. Because I just was infused with this deal, you know. And I loved it. And if you've gotten nothing else from my whole thing, why am I catechized? 7:45 and we're going till 8:30, huh? All right, then. Whoever laughs then, when it's about time and everything like that, get out. You know, there's always some old timer, and you know what? There's always somebody who every now and then kind of realizes that he has got this thing, and he slips into the edge, just the edge of creep, not total creep, but the fact is, but just a little old. Oh, come on, my apologies. The other thing. Because I do it all the time. I get excited about what I'm talking about, and I feel like I'm home. And you know what happens? I lose track of time. I lose track of time. But this deal is just—it's just been amazing. So I have a home group. I had my last drink on September 21st, 1989. On March 14th, 1990. March 14th, 1990, I was the night before I had an acting job. I was just a little nervous. I had a headache, and my girlfriend says, you want a Valium? And I went, you know, I used to have a prescription for Valium. And I didn't even think about it. I ate it. I went, there, that'll help. And it was March 14th, and I knew it wasn't a slip. And a month later, it was not a slip. And every now and then, for about 3-4 years, whatever, it was a long time, I would remember it. And it was not a slip, because I hadn't, you know, right now I would tell you that what happened is that my ego got between me and the truth. And my ego is a big wall, you know. And then I realized one day that I had never shared it with Jerry on his motorcycle. Jerry, who lived by his one bumper statement that he always asked me, he'd say, how are you treating the world today, Paulie? How are you treating the world today, Paulie? You know, and it's just, you know, that's the deal in a nutshell for me. That's the deal in a nutshell. I called Jerry, I realized it was literally what I had, you know, You've been jerking yourself around here, Paulie. Time to get on it. So I called and I told Jerry. I said, Jerry, I got to change my date. And he went, all right. What happened? I said, I ate a Valium. It belonged to Judy. And he said, well, all right, we start again. I said, well. And he said, when? I said, March 14th, 1990. And he went, well, there's a hell of a 10-step. Promptly admitted you were wrong. What the hell's been going on for the last... Progress, not perfection. I said, Jerry, I don't know. It's a beautiful example of this program to me. Same thing with making amends. I mean, when I sat down to do a fifth step and eventually got around to that place of like, now let's deal with our amends, I look back at my fifth step and every time, and they look at one name that I did not owe an amends to. I mean, this is a woman I worked with who's very famous, and it was like pulling teeth and everything, and her horrible, me fabulous. One night I'm lying in bed, I'm almost asleep, and there's this place between sleep and wake that is like a mail slot, and the big amigo delivers mail every now and then. And I'm lying there, and all of a sudden out of the blue I went, I owe that woman an amends. Oh my God. You arrogant little... She was wonderful. I mean, I looked at it, and it was like somebody just threw a light on it, and I went, God, look what she was dealing with. She's producing the biggest picture in her life. All this stuff's going on. So I did what I've been taught to do. I picked up the phone that next morning, and I said, Barbara, I have to apologize to you. I have been carrying around this batch of hilarious lines about our relationship that are absolutely untrue. Absolutely untrue. When I said it, when people asked me what it was like to work with you, I would say things that made them laugh. And I'm into this deal deep enough right now that I won't even tell you what the lines were because it was totally unfair to her. She bent over backwards to make sure that I could get the job done. And because I was a drunk, and somebody's bending over backwards to make sure I can get the job done, I'm thinking, you know, why are you getting messing with my job? I mean, it was this lovely little window of time in my life and such kindness that I just didn't see it. And of course, you start looking at all of it and it begins to change. It's just an amazing ride. It's an amazing ride. I have a relationship with my kids. My daughter lives in Colorado, and she's in the town that just was hit by the worst wildfire in the history. And, you know, somebody talks about, you know, me as a drunk, you know, like, you know, your dad looks like he's doing pretty good. They'll ask me, were you a high bottom drunk? And I say, ask my children. Ask my kids that I was not there for, that I ran away for, you know, some young lady for. Ask my kids. Ask the young lady who was in the car with me that I had a wreck because I was driving like my dad. My dad got luckier until he died, until he drove his car into an abutment of a bridge when I was 13. There is so many places in my life, so many little windows in my own history that I can look out of, and I see where the absolute grace of God, the God of my understanding, no. I have a God in my life that is massive. I mean, all I know is that it's everything that I can depend on anytime. All I have to do is think the word God, although I call him the big amigo. The big amigo is just right there anytime. You know, God of my understanding, no. I don't understand electricity either, but I use it. It lights up my life. It lights up my life. This is born in church basements. This deal was born in church basements. And the view from up here is spectacular, because I'll tell you what I see. I see a room full of people who did this. I'm gonna do a little theater for you right now. I go to my meeting when we're meeting on the beach. And I'm the guy that's on the 405 going, "Oh, yeah, lick me, whatever." And I show up at the street that we're on, where we were trying to get out and walk out on the beach. And I sit down there, and I'm just fine. You know, it's been an interesting week. And this is probably, not to the extreme, I stay pretty grateful. Gratitude and generosity, I think, are fuel, and it's born of this deal. But I'm sitting there in the circle, and she's all going, "You know, okay, she's going to talk about her daughter." Closet, you can't steer over the Amazon. You know, there's this guy that always disapproves of how long somebody shares. I'm going to owe you a meal when this is over. What's your name?
Leo.
Leo, that's right. Leo, I want to formally, in front of everybody, make an amend to you. I want to tell you that I've gone way too far here. You know. But Leo, well, I'm sitting in the meeting, and I'm Leo in this meeting at that point. Those are issues right there. And I know your heart, man. And I know that smile, man. I know that smile. I know you, Leo. I love you. I love you already. But I'm sitting there, and you know what? When I'm trying to take the reins, but I get up in the morning, and I go, "Lead me where you need me. Surprise me, God." What I'm doing when I say those two things is I'm handing the reins of my day to the big amigo here. You know, I never could see over the hill into the future, but you got a great view. You decide. You know, you decide. But when I'm taking the reins back, I get twitchy. I get twitchy. And I was 6 months at an AA meeting when I noticed nothing was moving, and I cried. I went, "Oh, my God. This is what it's like to be. To listen." Incidentally, I learned to listen, and now I can't hear. God has a great sense of humor. We're hearing it, you know. Finally learned to listen, now I can't hear. But I'm sitting there in this circle, which people are sharing, and I'm quiet. And then this guy, we'll call him Steve. Steve is sitting there, and it's like, "You know, my name's Steve, I'm an alcoholic, good to be back here. I got 5 years now, and, you know, the job's at, the job. And but home, you know, at home with the wife, and we have two kids now. And his body language just changes, and he goes, I can't do this anymore. I don't think I even have today." And the impact of that absolutely pure, honest moment changes everything. And that's how we got here. We were honest, you know. So this guy is having the worst day of his life. He's been on, like, I was a chronic and habitual liar to hide my drugs when I was drinking and saying I was sober. A chronic and habitual liar. But this guy's sitting there, and he honors us. He honors me and the rest of us with the truth. He says, "You know what? I need help." And you know what? We're shoving each other out of the way to help him, because that's the Kool-Aid. That's the deal. That's the beauty of God's mercy, and the fact that he could take somebody as selfish and arrogant as this little bastard and make him really want to be there for this person who's sharing that with me. It's just, how do you describe that to somebody, you know? How do you really sit down with somebody and say, "You know what? It's just, there's something about going on a 12-step call that you walk out of there just, you know, it's like, of course, I've got the ego, so I'm like, we were great, man. Well, obviously, you know, we were, but, you know, Oh man, did you notice? Did you talk about one of those man on the bed moments? We had one of those with them, don't you think? Oh, did it just go? That's the way I get. I'm going to say how I got sober. I'm going to say how I actually got sober. That phone call in a blackout. When I was 10 years sober, and I loved out. The turning point for me was in rehab, because I was in rehab and I loved it, and then all of a sudden I had that thing that was like, no, wait a minute, they've got it but I don't. You know, that anybody else have that moment? It's just like, and it's like, I can't drink again, what am I going to do? And it was, it's like the voice of my own addiction just going, come on back, you don't want it, you don't need to be here. And it just scared the crap out of me. And I pray to God with every mood that He put in me, every emotion, unrealistic, arrogant, scared, it all, whatever. And I didn't say it out loud, but inside me, I was like, God, they know something, and I can't do this anymore. I don't want to crawl through the puppy door so my girlfriend doesn't hear me going out to get drugs because the front door is squeaky. I don't want to drive with my kid. I don't want, it's like there's something I haven't seen that everybody else saw, and I don't know what it is. And I grabbed a piece of paper to write my drug history. They don't call it a... They used to not call it a first step in the rehab. And when I grabbed the piece of paper to write my drug history, I thought it was a blank piece of paper, but it wasn't. And I saw there was something printed on the other side. And I turned it over. And for the first time in my life, I read the words, God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I'm the better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties. The victory over them may bear witness to those that would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. And when I saw the word bondage of self, I went, that's exactly your problem, because from the very beginning, you would never admit you didn't know something. If somebody is, asked me a question, I would keep talking until I got out of the room and leave thinking that I knew what I was talking about, but I didn't. If somebody walks up to me today and they say, you're in the music business, you must know Walter Anderson, and I'm like, yeah, and I'm going up and down like Freddie Prinze's doggy in the window, it's like, yeah, and I have no idea who he's talking about. And eventually my recovery catches up with my head and I stop and I go, I'm sorry, I don't know who that is. I don't know who that is. And the guy's looking at me like, oh, boy, the hell is her going up with that? And he goes, well, you probably wouldn't. It's my wife's cousin. And he's like, well, I'm doing it. But why do we do that? And I think a lot of us do that. I think a lot of us feel like we're supposed to know. But what we're supposed to do is go, I don't know. How far is it to so-and-so? Why do you get this? I don't know. I go, hang on, let me give you a... I don't know. My arrogance and my ego and my fear, whatever, kept me away from being healed. Because it wasn't until I had misplaced that decade that I got to a place where I was like, you know what? I really need help. I really need help. And it's just, oh my God, you gave me my life back. And you gave me a life that I couldn't have imagined. I was 10 years sober, and I went to Nashville to write some more fix songs. And I was staying in the hotel. There was a convention of, I don't know who the hell these guys were, but I was at this hotel and I was writing songs during, and somebody said, I go to meetings wherever I'm traveling to, and I spent a lot of time in Nashville writing, and so would have two or three really great meetings I would attend, and I was asked if I would speak at the jail. So I went and I spoke at the jail, and it was like, here he is. It was sort of a combination of Jiminy Cricket and Gandhi, this speak at the jail, carry the message. I go back to the hotel, it's Jiminy Cricket and Gandhi. And I go through the lobby, and it's packed with all these really tall guys with huge belt buckles, and it's dangerous at my height. And I'm like making my way through all these guys, and look, there's horns and shit. It's like, excuse me. But I go up to my room, and I'm just feeling fantastic. I have carried the message. You know, I am an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've touched the hem, I will strike you sober. It's just like, and anyway, but I go to the room, and I reach in my pocket for the magnetic key. That's not the magnetic key. And it doesn't work. And I'm like, for the third night in a row, it's like, oh my God. So I go back downstairs, and you know, I have learned restraint of pen and tongue. I may be thinking, you know, you imbecile, but what I say when I get to the, and I go through all these guys, you know, and it's like packed. And I go through these guys, and I go up to the desk, and I say to the kid, you know what, I know it's not your fault. Because I'm a gentleman. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I said, I know it's not your fault, but why should I have to come back into this three nights in a row? Why should I? And at that moment, there's a tap on my shoulder. And I turn around, and there's a guy there, it's Gary, Oklahoma City. So I don't want to bother you. I just wanted to say hi. I booked these like 10 years ago, and I was like, Gary, and I looked at him, I said, I'm a booker, you know, I booked you at the, record, whatever the center was and all. He said, we're guys that book talent for rodeos and performing arts centers in Vegas and all like that and everything, but I booked you 10 years ago, and I said, are you the guy when I did my, let me, day, and he said, yeah, that was me, and I went, well, I'm saying you're sober now, and what do you do? I spoke at the jail, like blah, blah, Paulie, this, blah. Me, and me, and I, also. And he said, yeah, I heard in the rooms you were sober. And I went, are you a friend of Bill? And he reached in his pocket, and he pulled out a chip for 17 years. And I went, I did the math, and I said, you were 7 years sober when that happened. He said, that's right. I said, what did you think? He said, I thought you were dying. He said, I thought you were so sad and so scared. And he says, and it scared me. I said, yeah, I was really bad. I said, I was thrown down the escalator stairs. He said, there's no escalator in that car. There's no escalator. He said, I said, what did you do? He said, I called my sponsor. A moment to think about that. You know, what can happen when you come up against something that is senseless, out of control, and as soon as you've got it, like me, and you're new, what do you do? For everybody else that is as insane as I was, I hope you call your sponsor or at least talk to another alcoholic. Because what he did, I mean, he called his sponsor. I said, what did your sponsor do? He said, he hung up on me. And I said, why would he hang up on you? He said, so I could start making calls. And so could he. And I said, what were you doing? And he said, we were calling other alcoholics, and we put together a prayer circle of alcoholics in Oklahoma City. And we prayed that in or out of the rooms you would find relief. I have trouble getting through that without just being awash with gratitude. And there's absolutely no chance in this world, as far as I'm concerned, that those two things are not connected. Those alcoholics in Oklahoma City prayed for me, and in a blackout, I called a doctor. And that's as solid a truth as I ever share with anybody. I know that to be a fact, you know. It's just the greatest gift I've ever been given. The most amazing gift of my entire life. And my daughter, I talked to my daughter, and she said, you know, Dad, you finally hit full tilt, Papa Bear. You know, you're there for us. I said, you're there for me. It changed everything. It changed everything. And Somebody said once to me one time, I hope your recovery is slow. I think it has been. I think there was an awful lot of ego and wanting to, you know, part of the reason I say this works is because we can walk in and we can share something that we know is absolutely true and good with another human being that needs it. I'm overwhelmed with gratitude. Overwhelmed with gratitude. My morning meeting this morning, 11:15, we always have, it's a popcorn meeting. You share, somebody reads something from the big book, talks about it a little bit, and then shares. And then pick somebody else to share, and you pick somebody else. It's called a popcorn share. And this morning it was about acceptance, you know. Dr. Paul just, on page 449, how dare they change that? I can't accept that. but it was about acceptance. And the last couple of years, I've just been, you know, and he read the part that where it ends with being sure that in God's world, that there are no mistakes. And, somebody who'd never been in the meeting before was there, and she said, "You know what? I was lucky enough to be really good friends with Dr. Paul, and he said that's the only line he wished he hadn't written, because there are mistakes, you know, in God's world. I believe, you know, we're living through this pandemic, and then what we're in is, and it was an outside issue that had made its way into the meeting because it could not be ignored. Because you are my church, because you are my safe place, you know. And I loved hearing that. And I knew at the time I was going to speak tonight, I wanted to share that. That, you know, the fact is that what's going on right now, you know, I am powerless, but I am not hopeless. And my great hope is that we get through this. And, you know, I mean, I'm 81, but I've got a daughter and I've got grandchildren, and I know you all do, and my prayer is for them to have a long life, and if they drink too much, then, you know what, this will be there for them, this goes on, either, I mean, if we're all dust in the wind except for about 200, most of them will probably be alcoholics, and praise God that they keep this whole deal going, because it's the most amazing thing in the world. And I'll close with a story that I have, and it's a story about Margaret Mead, the anthropologist. And she was teaching a class, college, I imagine, and one of the students said, "Dr. Mead, what's the first sign of civilization that you found?" And she thought about it for a minute, and she said, "The first sign of civilization that we found is, to me, is a healed femur." And the guy was like, "Healed femur, you know?" And he figured it'd probably be maybe a bowl or a tool or a weapon, you know. Probably the first thing that somebody invented was a weapon, you know. She didn't know a healed femur. He said, "Why a healed femur?" She said, "Well, I'll tell you this. The femur is the longest bone in your body. I had my hip replaced, and they cut the top of it off and did all that. And so I know where my femur is. The femur is the longest bone in your body. And if you break your femur, you're in the animal world, you were pretty much lunch. That was basically it. You know, say goodbye. Hope you had a nice time. Lunch, you know. But when we found the healed femur, the femur takes about 15 weeks to heal. So when we found this healed femur, we realized this person had been probably picked up by maybe one or two, probably several people, and taken to a safe place. And for 15 weeks, they protected this person, brought him food, water, and took care of him until he was ready to go out and take care of himself." And I went, "That's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. I praise God every day. Thank you for this 12-step call. I love my life, and you gave it to me. God bless you.
I'd also like to welcome our newcomers.